You name it. That's journalism.
Famed Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. He died in June at the age of 92. He testified at the first Belmarsh Tribunal at the National Press Club last January. To see the full video of both Belmarsh Tribunals, visit democracynow.org. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kbu.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kbu.fm.
Follow KBU on Instagram at KBU Radio. Ear to the Streets.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBU Evening News.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. This is a special edition of the KBU Evening News, the best of 2023. I'm Althea Billings, news director here at KBU, and I have a head cold. From December 25th through January 1st, we're taking a look back at some of our best stories from the past year. Happy New Year! For the first show of 2024, we're looking back to look forward, meaning what stories from 2023 do we expect to have an impact on the year ahead? Up first, and arguably the biggest change for Portlanders, is the charter change, or government overhaul, that voters passed in 2022. The fall election will be the first one under the new system, and everything will have to be in place 1 year from today, on January 1st, 2025. Over the summer, current city commissioners Renee Gonzalez and Dan Ryan attempted to alter the amendment that voters passed. KBU covered the rally of supporters for the original ballot measure and caught up with proponents about what the charter change would mean and why it's so important. Robin Yee was one of those Portland Charter Review commissioners that helped design the ballot measure and the new system of government.
Over the past 100 years, our population tripled, and we had done nothing about the size of the city council. Charter reform also prioritized election dates where the highest number of Portlanders possible would weigh in on their city. This last-minute referral attempt runs counter to those principles that an overwhelming majority of Portlanders passed. We can either have a democracy, or we can have elections where results are ignored if it's unfavorable to powerful interests. But we cannot have both.
Right. Melanie Billings-Yoon was another Charter Review Commissioner who addressed the crowd.
Today, a mere 8 months later, before those reforms have even been implemented, Dan Ryan and Renee Gonzalez are pressing their fellow council members to overturn that election, to take away the representation and equity the public demanded. Why? According to Dan Ryan, he's simply offering voters another opportunity to weigh in. Because only now do they know what they voted for. And maybe what they actually want is more traditional government. I have news for Commissioners Ryan and Gonzalez. You are wrong.
Marcus Mundy is the executive director of the Coalition of Communities of Color. He had this to say to Commissioners Gonzalez and Ryan.
Our ask to City Council is clear. to allow the City of Portland to move forward with an implementation and transition process in which they are not interfering or causing further confusion among voters, which is probably what underlies this effort to sow confusion. But the voters were clear. The ability for communities of color and all Portlanders to obtain self-determination is deeply affected by the structure of our government and elections. This measure already is going to reduce barriers to communities of color, immigrants, refugees, and others to access services and have a stronger voice on city council. I cannot fathom why these commissioners would oppose such outcomes.
Inside City Hall, Commissioner Renee Gonzalez opened up the work session by saying that voters may need to reassess what they passed in the last election.
I want to be crystal clear at the kickoff, this is not done due to 2622A. All of this is to focus on what tweaks we might make to assure better implementation and a more effective government come 2025. So a couple of specific pieces on measure on this item, and particularly what we're doing to deliberate here. Again, we'll get into the particulars of the three components we're really evaluating, but there are a couple of opportunities to evaluate new information. So we have updated budget information. We're seeing some political trends emerge that may impact the way we think about this new charter. Also, we're a little bit on the clock, because candidates will start filing for 2024 very soon. In some cases, that's already occurred. This is probably our last chance before 2025 to really have a deep discussion. It's already a compressed timeline, fully recognize that. But it's sort of speak now or forever, keep your peace. And last but not least, we are at a historic moment in the city's history. We are facing simultaneous crisis of homelessness, crime, and drug problems. And one of the questions specific to our charter is, even if it has problems, let it play out. Let voters reassess after the fact. And I would submit for my colleagues and for the public, it is important for us to at least consider whether the City of Portland can take another experiment.
One of the changes Gonzalez and Ryan want to make is adding a mayoral veto. This would give the mayor the power to override policy that's passed by the council. Candace Avalos was one of the charter commissioners who said they considered a mayoral veto in their two-year process, but ultimately decided against it. Avalos was called on by Commissioner Ryan at the work session.
I think the most important thing to those of us who put together this proposal was, one, the extensive information we received from voters about their worry of the mayor having too much power over the council, especially because that council now being having an opportunity to be more representative. That balance was super important to voters. I think that I would not consider it a minor tweak. I would consider it a drastic change in the balance of the powers. And furthermore, I think more importantly, putting this to the voters on a ballot that not a lot of people are going to turn out to, because historically that is just not a year that people are paying attention to the ballots, to make such a significant change, I think is problematic. So, it would be best to first and foremost actually implement the charter change and see how it works and see the vision and have the new people that get elected to determine if that balance is correct, and if not, putting it on a future ballot where many people can weigh in to make that adjustment. I don't think any of us on the charter disagreed that there might be things that could, in the future be changed depending on how they work. I think we just strongly disagree with trying to do that now before we implement it on a ballot that is not going to be highly attended.
I mean, I guess what I would argue is that a veto is not the only way that the mayor has power to go back to a council and renegotiate or assess a decision. If that's the case, I don't think a council is going to be like, oh no, too bad, the dirt's bad, and you just have to make it work. The whole point of the relationship between those branches are to collaborate. And so we think that we've created an environment where there's equal power share. And in that kind of scenario, I don't see why the mayor couldn't go back and be a part of discussions with the council. Having a veto is not the only way to resolve that, is our opinion.
Ryan and Gonzalez also have a proposal to reduce the size of the city council from 12 members, three elected from each district, to 8. Commissioner Mingus Mapps questions Commissioner Gonzalez on this point.
Commissioner Gonzalez, if I may, just so I'm clear of what you're trying to achieve here, specifically what problem are you trying to solve by going from 12 to 8? Is this all about just reducing costs?
I think it's both the question of cost and the question of quality of candidates and quality of candidates.
I think I'm just going to make a statement as opposed to pose a question. I'm not sure. I don't know what to do with the managing the quality of candidate space. Portland is a big town full of lots of really creative, smart people.
Mike Alfoni is the co-founder of Rank Choice Oregon. Ryan and Gonzalez put forward a proposal to, quote, simplify the single transferable rank choice voting currently in the works. Here's how Alfoni responded to their proposition.
Both the charter review process and the statewide HB 2004 process were years in the making, involving dozens of people, many who were much smarter than I am, who have fancy degrees, ensuring that these things worked well. A multi-week process by a small group in City Hall attempting to put something on the ballot is very dangerous from the perspective of, like, you may have intended certain consequences you're intending or certain results you want to come from it, but both the legal and actual political ramifications for voters in terms of how they view it or how it actually elects representatives requires a much more long, thorough, and in-depth process to look at. And I would just warn that any rush process behind this should probably be taking months, if not years, not weeks. And that's how both the other two things have gone. And still, we're working through some of the details. And one of the reasons for our implementation date we moved back was to ensure we had multiple legislative sessions to ensure continued, edits we're able to make on a statewide level. I think the thing in my mind is that it doesn't matter what the proposal is, it's going to be an absolute mess. Multiple proposals coming through, they get approved charter reform, that gets changed again, and then the voter campaign. You know, there'll be money, I'm sure, put on both sides of it, which is going to be more loud noise going on in the city. In a time that people already distrust elections, I mean, this is why we work on this stuff, right? It's because democracy is a dumpster fire right now. There are huge concerns at the city and national level, and to go back and forth in front of voters, it makes us look like a clown car. And it's not going to build trust. And I can't imagine that the implementation work gets any easier should these pass or not, or this goes any better with an even shorter, more compressed timeline if there are changes. I just don't see how that's anything good.
Mayor Ted Wheeler attended the work session via Zoom, appearing to be in his car. He voiced skepticism about the efforts of the commissioners.
We have not even yet implemented what the voters have asked for, and yet we're already proposing that we go back to the voters with changes. We can always change these things later. We can change them in a year and a half after the first city council has an opportunity to convene and see how important these issues are.
City staffers also reported that adding measures to a November 2023 ballot would cost the city over $600,000, since they'd be the only jurisdiction holding a special election. But it hasn't come to that yet. Portland City Commissioners will vote on referring the ballot measures that Ryan and Gonzalez proposed next week. So far, at least 3 commissioners seem skeptical. You are listening to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. On today's show, we're looking back at specific stories from the past year that are not yet finished, ones we expect to develop further. Another critical political issue facing Oregon is its drug addiction and treatment crisis. Many have pointed the finger at Measure 110, Oregon's drug decriminalization and treatment measure that voters passed in 2020. Statistical research supports the assertion that drug decriminalization did not make the addiction and overdose crisis worse, but it came at a difficult time during a huge influx of fentanyl into the United States. In 2023, some lawmakers and advocacy groups indicated their intention to quote-unquote fix Measure 110, but what that means and if it's a good idea isn't widely agreed upon. I'm here with Tara Hurst, the Executive Director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. To start out here, can you tell me a little bit about your organization?
Sure. So the Health Justice Recovery Alliance has been working to ensure that the implementation of Ballot Measure 110 was done as the voters intended. And for us, that really means making sure that we are moving addiction from a criminal justice response to a healthcare response, and also really making sure that, you know, we know that communities of color have been, and especially Black, Latino, Indigenous, Tribal, and Native communities specifically, have been over-incarcerated and under-treated. And so making sure that the services that are being stood up are really focused on culturally and linguistically specific care, and ensuring that we are getting the right services into the community that are really going to help people get onto the road to recovery.
Well, last week, state lawmakers announced the creation of a joint interim committee on addiction and community safety response. From your perspective, where does that fit into addressing the addiction crisis and Measure 110?
So I think it's an important committee because it starts zooming out on this is not a, what we're feeling in a lot of our communities is not as a result of Measure 110, but because we want something to attach what we're seeing onto. Measure 110 has been a very reliable scapegoat, if you will. And so this committee is really saying, okay, let's zoom out. We have an addiction crisis in Oregon. There's an addiction crisis in the all over the country, but we're focused on Oregon, obviously, because it's the Oregon State Legislature. So what is it that we need to really be effective in meeting, in making sure that we have rapid access to care for people when they need it? So currently, we have people lined up outside of Hooper Detox every day trying to get a detox bed. That is not acceptable, right? That is not how we're going to solve our addiction crisis. We also have, I think it's 3 out of 10 folks who have gone through Hooper Detox, and this isn't any, you know, detox is about 3 to 7 days predominantly, because it's a medically like supervised space where to make sure that you don't die as you're coming off of substances. And we know that 3 out of 10 folks leave Hooper without housing, also unacceptable. So there's a lot of gaps in care that we need to be looking at the bigger system and figure out what do we need. We know that we're at a 50% capacity of what we're supposed to have. That's according to the OHSU and the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission study that came out last year. We also know that, like, sometimes these problems feel too big, and so we just keep talking about them and don't do. And so I think this, my hope for this joint committee is that we can have not just conversations about here's the best way to treat addiction and here's all the services that we need, because that's a conversation that absolutely has to happen and needs to get solidified. But then it's, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you know, make sure that all these different providers who are ready to open up new recovery houses, who are able to open up new detoxes, that they are getting funded right now so that we can be building out this system. And then I think it also is trying to address that there are some community safety concerns, and we don't necessarily have the best response, right? We know that police in most communities are understaffed and aren't able to address all of these issues. And quite frankly, most folks, including the police, don't want to be the ones having to respond to somebody who's in a crisis, a mental health crisis. And they're not the right people. So how do we build out a community safety response that is really cognitive on best practices and evidence on what's the best for the community member, especially the one in crisis? And I don't think it's only the person who is having an actual mental health crisis at the moment, but it's also the folks around, and it's also, you know, our local businesses, and making sure that we can get our spaces back to being livable, but not by harmful and harsh punishments, but by having the right people addressing the issues that they are most suited to address. So my hope is that that's the conversation we'll be having in that joint committee. It's got a lot of thoughtful folks on it, and I feel confident that we'll be able to to work through a lot of the issues and continue to zoom out. Measure 110 didn't create this problem, and it's not going to solve this problem. So how do we make sure that we are really looking at all of the things that need to happen in order for us to really treat this addiction crisis as a crisis, and come up with sustainable and stable solutions that can really move us forward long term and not these quick band-aid fixes that don't fix anything.
There's also a political group that formed recently with a plan to quote unquote fix Measure 110, and it's attracted large donations already from some of Oregon's wealthiest people. They want to recriminalize the possession of hard drugs and shift oversight of the programs away from the Oregon Health Authority. What are your thoughts on their plan, on that effort?
So they're not fixing Measure 110, they're repealing it and gutting it. So I think we need to be really clear about that. This whole idea that they're fixing Measure 110, and unless fixing measure, they're doing things that Measure 110 didn't even address, like dealing and creating, and they're creating new crimes for people. They're also, I think what they're doing is doubling down on the criminal justice response. So they're saying we need to force people into treatment. Even though we don't have the treatment, we don't have the public defenders, and we don't have the jail beds, which would be extremely costly, if that was even what the voters wanted, right? The voters were very clear. We want a healthcare response because addiction is a healthcare issue. How we get there, I recognize that we're all grappling with, right? What is the best way to do that? And how do we do that in a way that is causes the least amount of harm? And that's really important. So this Fix 110 is not a fix, it's a repeal. And it does even more damage because it takes all of the funding, even though they're not willing to be forthright about this, it takes all the funding away from the Measure 110 services that have just gotten up and running, are doing incredible things for communities across our state. And it diverts it to cities, counties, schools, and to the criminal justice response, so the diversion. $200 million is not going to be enough to do that. And then it talks about we need to create treatment and detox and prevention. I think we 1,000% do need to invest in all those things. That is the CCO's job, to invest in clinical services, the detox and treatment centers. And I mean, everybody's been reporting on it. They have between what, $400 and $800 million in profits. I think that we shouldn't be giving them a pass and using Measure 110 funds for that, right? They have the funding. They need to figure out what's the best way to use that, and we need to pressure that to happen. And then it takes it out of OHA, but it doesn't, because the Alcohol Drug Policy Commission is in OHA. So it shuffles the deck chairs, and what it does more importantly is it takes away the Oversight and Accountability Council. And the Oversight and Accountability Council is the first of its kind. I mean, this is a group of people with lived experience who are predominantly from communities who've been most impacted by the war on drugs, have the professional and lived experience to be able to determine where these funds need to be and will have the greatest impact on the communities. So it takes it away from the bureaucracy, and it's really about getting the money right out into the provider's hands, who can have the biggest and best impact on folks at the street level. It's not, and so to say that they're not taking the services means that they need to find $1 billion in order to fund all the things that are in their measure. And that's just not going to happen. And then it promises automatic expungement, which is not something that is readily available to anyone, and it's not something that our state has the systems to do. So I think that the folks who are giving money to this campaign, you know, when we talk to providers, what could you do with $700,000? I mean, we could be opening up new stabilization housing. We could be opening up new recovery housing with that money. We could increase outreach downtown by a significant amount. So we need to be solving for the problems that are real, and Measure 110 is not the problem. It's part of a solution, and we need to continue to, you know, make it better, And fix is fine, but that is not a fix. That's a repeal. So I think it's just really important for people when they're getting their information to recognize that, that when you read the measure, it is a repeal, and then it's like a repeal plus, plus, plus. There's a lot of extra added bonuses in there. If you support the criminal justice response to addiction, we know that 25 states have higher overdose death rates than Oregon, and they all have higher, stiffer criminal penalties for people who use drugs. So criminal penalties doesn't equal safer, and it doesn't equal less deaths. It amounts to a higher cost for poor outcomes. You're 27 times more likely to die 2 weeks out of leaving jail or prison of an overdose. It is not the appropriate place to get health care, and it's a very expensive place to get health care. So it's not solving the problem, it's making the problem worse. And I hope that voters and the public can see and read between the lines, or just read the lines of the measure, and you'll see this is really harmful policy.
Well, you mentioned that Measure 110's implementation has really started in terms of the services about 11 months ago. What do we know so far about what kind of impact it's had?
We know that in the third quarter, we've seen a 174% increase between quarter one, and quarter one is July 2022 through October, and then October through December is quarter two, just to give everybody a grounding in what we're talking about. So between quarter one and quarter three, we've seen 174% increase in screenings, that's checking in, seeing like, what do you need? What kind of medical care could you need? Do you need housing, addiction treatment supports? 106% of assessments. We've got an 104% increase in SUD treatment in three quarters. We've had a 143% increase in peer support services. Housing services saw a 190% increase, and our harm reduction services had a 91% increase in services in the past three quarters. We're about 6 months behind with a data lag, and so just even in the beginning, when most people hadn't even gotten their full funding, those are the types of numbers you're seeing. The impact is significant, right? So because they can't take it all out of were these unique visits, it's hard to give exact numbers, but you're seeing 7,000 people or encounters with treatment in just a quarter, 11,000 people engaging or services being given in peer support and housing. You're looking at 2,000 people a quarter being able to access housing services. So it's an extremely significant amount of access that is shifted. But remember that we had a fully starved, broken system. So these types of numbers, even though they're extremely impressive, they're not going to be felt by the full community because we have lines out the door for detox still. We still have major wait lists for housing. We have a lot of work to do to keep growing. We still need a lot of inpatient beds. We're at 50% of our capacity. So that means that we only have half of the amount of treatment spaces for the people that need it. And that's the crisis we're facing. And I just really want our leaders to focus on that and not on these kind of short, quick political, stances, because people are dying.
That was Tara Hurst, the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, speaking with me about recent legislative actions concerning Oregon Measure 110, the drug decriminalization and treatment law. You are tuned in to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. This is our first show of 2024, and while we're looking back, we're also looking forward, showcasing stories from the past year that we're likely to see again.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. We are joined in studio this evening, very excited, by three forest and land defense activists who are in Portland for the rally and counter conference to the Who Will Own the Forest Industry Conference. We've got Grandma Losa, a Coast Salish elder and land defender, Joshua Wright, a forest defense activist, and Sean Jacobson from the City Repair Project. Welcome to KBOO News in Depth, all.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So there is definitely a lot to talk about with the rally and the counter conference, but maybe we can start out by talking about Ferry Creek. It's now referred to as one of the largest acts of civil disobedience in Canadian history, where protesters created a blockade aimed at ending old growth logging in British Columbia. Maybe for our listeners, what is the significance of Ferry Creek?
Ooh, it's the last of the old growth. It is 3 years old, and we're still occupying the space.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how it started and what's been going on?
I'll take that, yeah.
Sure.
So in British Columbia, the province is still authorizing the logging of around 100,000 acres of old growth forests with trees that are up to 2,000 years old and 10 feet thick. And a couple of years ago, a group of land defenders decided to set up a blockade in one of the last intact watersheds on Vancouver Island to prevent the logging of the headwaters of that valley. And that led to the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. And since then, land defenders have been trying to hold down the fort, trying to protect old growth. And really what we're seeing is that the government has been promising protections for a long time and failing to deliver. And industry in the meantime is hacking away at the last of the old growth as they're doing basically across the Coast Range, hacking away at the last areas of natural forest. And that's why we're here at the conference.
So where does Ferry Creek stand now, right? That 2020 and 2021 were a more intense time. What's happening currently?
Currently what's happening is that